Good morning. You guys look all right. Yeah, wonderful. He mentioned Gary Stravell, who has come up to be with me. He's a member of my board, and he is very kind to me, so he'll be helping me with my table today. I do want to add one thing to this. First of all, well, two things, really. The basic price of the Jesus style is $13. So you're getting it for less than what bookstores pay for it. So the other one, the Spanish Jesus style. Oh, yeah, thank you. If you want 10 or more because you're interested in using them as giveaways, then you can get those for $2 each then. We subsidize that because we want to, we did it. There are 15,000 copies, which we did free, in Cuba floating around. And it's had a significant impact on Cuba. The way we got to do it, there just happens to be a guy who knew how to do it, you know. And he actually, you had to print them over there. We couldn't send them over. And so we paid for the printing, and he would print a few in one place so that the government wouldn't take notice of it, and store them in a secret place and another secret place. And a certain denomination discovered one of the places where he had had them stored and absconded with them. But that's okay. They still got delivered out to people, and that was okay, you know. With some of them, they didn't get all of them. So we like to see that one go out. And if you know that you can use it in evangelistically or in teaching to give away, then we'll be glad to sell them to you in bulk, you know, for a lesser amount. Well, would you like to hear another cowboy poem? Now you're driving me back to my Oklahoma farm days, man. This is entitled Jake the Rancher. I don't know who wrote it, but it also is available on my website, free of charge. You can download it. Jake the Rancher went one day to fix a distant fence. The wind was cold and gusty, and the clouds rolled gray and dense. As he pounded the last staples in, and gathered tools to go, the temperature had fallen, and the snow began to blow. When he finally reached his pickup, he felt a heavy heart. From the sound of that ignition, he knew it wouldn't start. So Jake did what most of us would do if we had been there. He humbly bowed his balding head and sent aloft a prayer. As he turned the key for the last time, he knew he had lost his luck. They found him 3 days later, frozen stiff in that old truck. Now, Jake had been around in life and done his share of roaming, but when he saw heaven, he was shocked. It looked just like Wyoming. Oh, there were some differences, of course, but just some minor things. One place had simply disappeared, the town they call Rock Springs. The BLM had been shut down, and there was no grazing fees, and the wind in Rawlins and Cheyenne was now a gentle breeze. The Park and Forest Service folks, they didn't fare so well. They'd all been sent to fight some fire in a wilderness called hell. Though heaven was a real nice place, Jake had a wandering mind, so he saddled up and rode away, not knowing what he'd find. Then one day up in Cody, on a cold fall afternoon, he saw St. Peter coming, and he knew he'd be there soon. Of all the saints in heaven, his favorite was St. Peter. Now this line, it ain't needed, but it helps with rhyme and meter. So they sat and talked a minute or two, or maybe it was three. Nobody was keeping score. In heaven, time is free. I've always heard, Jake said to Pete, that God will answer prayers. But one time I asked for help, well, he just plain wasn't there. Does God answer prayers of some and ignores the prayers of others? That don't seem exactly square. I know all men are brothers. Or does he randomly reply without good rhyme or reason? Maybe it's the time of day, the weather, or the season. Now, I ain't trying to act smart. It's just the way I feel. And I was wondering, Pete, could you tell what is heaven's deal? Well, Peter listened very patiently, and when Jake was done, there were smiles of recognition, and he said, "So you're the one." That day your truck, it wouldn't start, and you sent your prayer a-flying. You gave us all a real bad time with hundreds of us trying. 1,000 angels rushed to check the status of your file. But you know, Jake, we hadn't heard from you in quite a while. And though all prayers are answered and God ain't got no quota, he didn't recognize your voice and started a truck in North Dakota. Back to Matthew chapter 20. When we we didn't finish when we quit last night. What? Yeah, we stopped at Roman numeral 1. We actually had encountered an apostolic fight, you know. Now, you never think of it that way, but that's what those guys were, man. It was like they were playing a constant game of scratch basketball, you know. And there were no rules. And Jesus patiently taught them. I am so amazed at that. Don't raise your hands, but do you ever think that God's just a bit upset with you? You ever think you're on probation? You know, and he's saying, one more time? You know? Or, ay, ay, ay. If I'd have known. You know? But that's not the way God looks at us. The fact that he would stick with those apostles should be the most encouraging thing in the world. They were absolute jerks. They really were. They did not help his reputation one bit. In fact, they hurt his reputation. In fact, when Jesus came back down from the Mount of Transfiguration, he said to the disciples, really, this is what he said. He said, "What were you fighting with the people about?" You know, they had gotten a fight with the people. And anyway, that's another story. I don't have time for that. But now Jesus interrupts their fighting because James and John had pulled a sneaky on them and got Mama to be a lobbyist for them to try to get the two top positions. And when the other guys found out about it, it started another fight. Jesus called them together and in essence said, "Let me give you a leadership seminar. Get your slates ready." Roman numeral 1 is where we left last night. The rulers of the Gentiles. Oh boy, yeah, rulers of the Gentiles. I can hear the guy saying, "I've often wondered how they do it." They rule a whole world, man. They're good. They do it, man. Rulers of the Gentiles, tell me how. Point A, they lord it over them. Oh yeah, I like that. Lord it over. Yeah. Point B, they exercise authority over them. Oh, I love that. Exercise authority. Yeah. Now, doesn't that sound like the world? That's exactly the way it operates. When people give these high-priced leadership seminars, what they're teaching you how to do is to do it the way the world does it, just smoother and better. And so they're staring at their notes. Oh, man, this is great. And Jesus says, "Not so with you." Instead, whoever wants to be great, and guys, we all do, we may as well admit it, let them be your servant, huh? Now, isn't that exciting news? Man, I always wanted to be a servant. You know, I've often thought, what if I were to go on television like some hucksters I've seen and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have an incredible offer for you today. If you'll send me 500 bucks, I'll send you 15 books and 12 tapes, and in 1 week you too can be a slave. My mother might send something, but that's not exciting territory. As I mentioned last night, nothing flies in the face of the real Gail Irwin as much as that statement, man. Because I'm a guy, I want to be in charge, you know. I think we've had the wrong president for decades. You know, it should have been me. And we all think in terms of, well, hey, if I were in charge or if I could do it, you know, it's just the typical us. It's the human condition. It was the thing that Adam and Eve fell to, you know. I want to be in charge. I want to be like God. It's the temptation of the Mormons, you know. That's what their promise is. You too can be a God. It's literally. And that attracts people, yeah. And Jesus said, hey, you want to be great? You want to be top? Then you got to be a servant. Oh, boy. Now, at this point, because I wanted to go ahead and talk about the next one, because I need to do some explaining. Here are tickets. What are these tickets to? Are they giving away things? Oh, my. I think I'll keep these. I might win something. Jesus goes on and says, if you want to be first, and we all do, I'll never forget that year that Detroit lost all of their football games. Remember that, some of you? I think they went 0-16. I think they're on their way again this year. Or somebody is. And I watched a game, and you know, I could understand why they lost. But one guy scored a touchdown. A Lion. And man, he ran through the end zone. Like that. Number one. Number one. Now, I don't know if that meant first touchdown. Or the dream that they had. But we all want to be number one. I started playing football in junior high school. When I got to high school, I didn't play football. They played it on me. It was like I moved to a different town and they played semi-pro ball. But my junior high school team lost all six of its games. But my coach never, ever said, our goal this year is to lose every game. No, man, he would tell us, you guys have it. We can do it. Get out there and show them, man, you know. And, well, we would show them what a wreck looked like. I was fullback. I never knew what hit me sometimes in some of those games. But we all want to be number one. It's built in us. Here's the thing. Jesus never said you shouldn't be that way. He never said you shouldn't want to be great. The only question is, how do you get there? And so whoever wants to be first, let him be your slave. Oh, man. Now, those are loaded words, which I need to explain to you right now. Our country has not yet gotten over its days of having slaves. Our country, when it was formed, was a slave-holding country. It's been part of our shameful past, the whole past that we have. And so the very word slave brings up in our minds some terrible things, and it ought to. But what Jesus was talking about was a different kind of slavery. You see, that slavery was slavery by force. This is slavery by choice. If I choose to serve you in a way that would look like I'm being your slave, that's my choice. And when I get to choose what I do, it's a joyful thing. But I'm going to prove this to you later on, tonight, actually. But so when he's inviting us to be a slave, it is, he's not inviting us to be a forced slave, but a choosing one who says, I care so much for you. You are so important to me because God's crazy about you, and I'm not going to put you down. In fact, I'm going to try to make life better for you. I'm going to try to do things that will enhance your life because of my choice. Now, sometimes it means that you won't do what people want you to do because you know that's not good for them, and you can't bring yourself to do that because now it's your choice. But if it were slavery of our past, you would do whatever was commanded of you because you didn't have any choice. But we are servants, we are slaves by choice because we know how much God values you. I don't want to put you down. I want to make life better for you. One of the things that God has taught me, you know, everywhere we've gone, everywhere we've lived, we've asked God to give us our neighbors, you know. And He's done it, you know. We've won them to the Lord. I haven't been that successful where I currently am because it's an alternate lifestyle around me and we never see each other, you know. We just move in different circles. But one neighbor right next to me, I've had wonderful, wonderful opportunity to witness to them. And I know it's had an effect to them. I haven't yet brought them. They've moved away. Maybe it was getting too close. I don't know. But they moved to Idaho. What a strange place to live. You know? But at any rate, I found that when I am thinking of ways to bless them and to serve them, it's like life changes for them. They become open. They know I don't have, even though they know I'm a preacher, they know that I'm not the typical preacher that says, you give me a chance and I'll pull a pulpit up right in front of me, you know. But they know that I'm a real person, I care for them, and I want to do what I can to help them. And they become very open to the gospel. It's amazing, you know. Well, that's servanthood by choice. That's what the effect of servant. Jesus even said, you know, if a guy forces you to go a mile, go with them what? 2 miles. Now, that doesn't make any sense to my natural mind until I stop and think. Now, wait a minute. He forced me to go the first one, but I'm going to show him how I operate. I choose to go the second mile. Because he won't understand that, and he's going to want to know, why did you do this? Well, thank you for asking. You know? If he takes your coat, beat him up. No. Give him your cloak. Why in the world would you do that? Because the first one was something that happened to me by force, but now I want you to see that I'm cut from different cloth and I'm going to do something for your benefit regardless of what you've done for me, because that's what I do by my choice. That opens doors. That opens doors. I'm fascinated by the fact that when that earthquake, and I'm in earthquake country, I can see the San Andreas Fault from my house. It's really a beautiful thing, but I command it to be still. It's obeyed me for 30 years. But when that earthquake opened up the doors of the jail and was so strong, it actually shook the handcuffs off of Paul and Silas. Remember that? They had been doing something I would not have done. They had been beat up first, and here they are in this jail. I would have been complaining, God, look at what I've done for you. I gave up everything. I was big man on my campus, man. And now look at this. Here I am. They beat me up and for a living for you, and I don't even know where my Mercedes is, you know. That's what I would have done. Paul and Silas, they sang, they prayed until midnight. Now, I don't know if you realize it, but you know, the worship service is good sermon. Somebody come in, they don't know who you are, and they look at what you're saying about God. What an incredible witness. Like, you know, you like their guy did, he kind of gave an altar call right at the end of that. And that's appropriate. It was wonderful. And when you hear someone pray, and you're praying for other people, praying even for the people that beat you up, that's different. And so all of those prisoners and the jailer, listen to that, until midnight. And then there was the earthquake. It opened the doors. Now, let's put ourselves there. If I'd have been Paul, or one of those prisoners, and that earthquake shook the handcuffs off of me and opened the door, you know what I'd have done? Thanking Jesus with every step. But they didn't move. Even the prisoners didn't move. Why? A strange thing had happened in that jail. God had gotten to the hearts of every one of those people from what they had heard Paul and Silas singing and praying about. And they knew that if they ran away, they would kill the jailer, because that was the way they dealt with it. And the jailer had a knife prepared to kill himself. Now we would say, hurry up and do it. But Paul said, do yourself no harm. We're still here. And it's like suddenly understanding encompassed the whole place. And the jailer, he gave the altar call. I love it when the crowd gives the altar call. And he said, men and brethren, that's what they did on the day of Pentecost. He says, what must I do to be saved? And of course, you know, Paul told him, well, you need to first confess your sins, and then you need to listen to certain commentators on television and radio, and you need to vote for certain people, and so forth. No. It's right simple, isn't it? Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and you'll be saved, and your household. Now, a lot of Presbyterians believe that that was a covenant, that if we get saved, God will make sure that our household gets saved too. Now, it's a little hard to prove that, but I still like it. You know? I'll say, okay, God, my household, look at you said it, you said it. So when Jesus is describing this, look, whoever wants to be great, let him be your servant. Whoever wants to be first, let him be your slave. Keep in mind, this was exactly what Jesus was doing with these guys. They were observing it in action because his next words were, just as. Those words move me. Now you may think, you're weird, Erwin. Yeah, I am, I agree. But those words move me. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Huh. My wife had gone to visit her folks at one point, and I was waiting at the Ontario, California airport for her to return. And in the old airport, the plane would nose right up to the big window, and they'd roll a ladder up to it, and you'd come down. And I watched as two guys with these aluminum-colored briefcases come out, dressed, you know, in suits, and I realized there's somebody important on this plane, because ordinary people don't carry suitcases like that. And then two more guys came out with suits on and with these silver-colored briefcases, big ones. And then a former president came out. And they helped him down the stairs and made sure he didn't bump his head. That tells you who he was. And then two more guys came down and they sped off in these limousines, you know. And I thought, boy, he surrounds himself with servants. What did Jesus do that was so different? He surrounded them with his servanthood. Nothing proves it more than that moment that we call the Last Supper, when these guys had not experienced what was about to happen. They were gathered around a table, and did I describe that table a bit last night? It was a low table. You reclined, you laid down. It would be on something soft, maybe, you would reach over, and with your right hand, you would eat. You'd never touch the food with your left hand. If you go somewhere where they eat with their hands, please remember to eat it with the right hand. Their left hand is for other things. Anyway. They would recline at this table, and it was shaped like a squared-off horseshoe, and their feet would stick out like the spokes of a wheel, their bodies would. And this is an important thing to know, because it helps explain what went on in their lives. They would seat themselves at this table according to rank. Every meal was a fight. You realize what's going on? You sat here last time. You don't belong there. I belong there. It's my turn. Now, these were apostles. You did not hear, "Oh, please, brother, would you take my place higher?" They were part of the biggest thing ever to happen in Israel. They were executives now, man. And they're walking with a Messiah, man. Hey, he's got a camera. Get over here by Jesus. Yeah. They were typical men from the streets. They understood humanity. They understood how they were supposed to act as men. It's for you. There was one thing about that table that a lot of people don't understand, too. You know, if Mike Fenicio, you're here. If I were to knock on your door today, I know what you'd do. Gail, good to see you. You'd hug me, come in, have a seat. Let me get you a cup of Christian crack. Coffee. Now, those are American greeting rituals. We have the simplest greeting rituals in the world. But if this were 2,000 years ago, and I knocked on your door, "Gail, good to see you. You kissed me on both cheeks," which they still do in some places. "You would seat me, and if I were especially welcomed, you would anoint my head with oil." Now, we do that often when we pray for the sick. James told us to, and usually in pulpits we have this little tiny bottle of olive oil, you know, toot, toot, toot. That's okay, but that's not what they did back then. They would take, if you were really welcome, I mean, this would be for top dudes, you'd take a bottle of olive oil and empty it on their head and slick it down. Yuck. But this was before the days of shampoos and hair dryers, and that was a very soothing, cleansing, honoring thing, and healing thing to do. It was a great thing. But there's another advantage to that. If I were to leave Mike's house today, being especially welcome, who would know? But back then, everybody would know. Somebody loves that dude. Look at that greasy head, you know. But if this were 2,000 years ago, there would be one other thing that would be part of the greeting ritual, and it was extremely important, that we have no concept of today. You'd wash my feet. Now, everybody wore sandals. The roads were but dust. It didn't take long before it was very uncomfortable walking. And hospitality is the art of making people comfortable. Now, the problem is, if you had servants, it would be your lowest ranked servant that would wash feet. Why? Because it was the worst job in the world. The lowest job in the world. Why? Because they believed, as Muslims and Arabs still do to this day, that the bottom of the foot was the dirtiest part of the body. Oh man, we don't believe that. So now, if you had no servants, then you would wash my feet, but it would be a public admission of your low estate. So here are 13 people gathered around this table. Nobody's feet had been washed. Why? Well, what were they arguing about? Remember? Not who's the least, who's the greatest. Oh. John, who sat in the first position over here as the kind of the highest ranked of the apostles, and he tells us that he was. Because he says he was the disciple who Jesus loved, who leaned against his breast. Now, I first read that and I thought, what kind of guys were these anyway? But what he's doing is he's telling us where he reclined. He was number one guy, which I don't have time to explain all of that to you. And Jesus would have been the number two in there as the host. And he is telling you where he sat. In order to speak to Jesus, he had to lean back against his chest. Voila, I'm the biggest, bestest. You would think that he might wash feet. Oh, no. Just to shorten this, Peter sat at the lowest ranked seat all the way around. What was he doing there? And he's wondering himself. There's no place for a pope, you know that. I do wonder sometimes why Peter got there. And I think it happened this way, you know. In the part of the argument, he said, well, wait a minute, guys, who walked on water? And they say, yeah, and who sank? That's right. Well, who had the great revelation that he was the Messiah? Yeah, and to whom did he say, get behind me, Satan? Right, I said, yeah, that's right. But then when Jesus interrupted their argument and said, guys, remember, whoever wants to be great's got to be last, got to be your servant. I think Peter said, oh yeah, that's right. I'll sit over here. We all know why, don't we? I can hear it. But none of them had washed any feet. John's probably thinking, why didn't Peter wash feet? Peter said, I ain't washing feet. If I do, they'll think I belong here. The guys up on the top tier were probably thinking, why doesn't somebody do something? Of course, you never hear that at church. Why doesn't the church do something, Pastor? Why doesn't the church this, you know? I had a good reputation. Well, not I didn't really have a good reputation, but I had a reputation. At the church I served, and they would say it from the pulpit, we have learned that to make a recommendation to Pastor Irwin is to volunteer. So you got to see what happened. That was the lowest job in the universe. So the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the Savior of our souls, the Creator of the universe, gets up from that table and washes their feet by his choice. And he ends that by saying, you call me Lord and Master, and I am. And I am your example. You ought also to wash one another's feet. Now, we don't do that much nowadays. It's because we don't understand it. See, it's not part of our culture, and so it's really probably inappropriate to do it. But if you understand what it's about, then foot washing takes on a different sort of thing. Anytime, keep in mind, this was a cleansing thing. It was an honoring thing. It was a welcoming thing. It was a soothing thing. It was a healing thing. When we do anything like that for someone, we've actually washed their feet without it, our calling it that. And sometimes I'll actually say to people who do something like that for me, I say, you just washed my feet, thank you. And they're in shock. They didn't know that's what they did. But Jesus says, this is the way we're to treat people. Do the dirtiest job if necessary for their cleanliness and their help, their welcome, so forth. Wow. But he said, I'm your example. And when he said, just as, you know, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many, he was describing Christian leadership. I am convinced that the only valid form of leadership in the kingdom of God is leadership by example. I'll show you how. I'll show you what it means. I won't just tell you and ask you, why aren't you doing it? You know? Something sometimes happens to us when we get behind a pulpit like this. It's finally, all right, I've had a lot of things I wanted to tell you. It's my turn, you know. No. I don't like pulpits. I don't like barriers like this. I tried to figure out how to jump over it, but I'm not as young as I used to. I'd wipe out the whole front row falling. But Jesus led by example. I want to tell you a couple of stories. I served my last pastorate, which is prophetic, by the way. Last pastorate. Was in La Puente, California, which is a rough area, sort of an extension of East Los Angeles. And my first year there were 23 gang killings in my little town of 29,000. It's kind of neighborhood it was. But I had raised up two guys in the congregation to be assistants. One as assistant pastor, and he was a banker. And boy, did he take a pay cut. His wife never forgave me for asking him. I didn't know that till his funeral, that she hated my guts. Oh. And the other one was a guy whose brother had won the MVP World Series thing twice in a row. And all he was just a, shall we say, a common worker, you know. So he lived under the shadow of his famous brother. And I asked him to become the youth pastor. You know. And one day after service, a little guy came up to just greet him after service. And he said to him, "Hey, go ask your parents if you can go home with us. We'd love to have you come home and have dinner, Sunday dinner with us." You know. "Really? Yeah, go ask." I mean, he shot a 6 feet into the air, turned around in the air, and ran away. And I said, "Jack, that's really not part of your portfolio. Why are you doing that?" And what he told me, I almost cry every time I think about it. He said, "You see, Jack, you see this couple over here, older couple?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "When I was that age, they did that to me. They said, 'Would you come home with us? We'd just love to have you come and eat with us.'" And he said, "I remember what that did for me as a kid, you know, not thinking that the world was on my side at all." And he said, "I want to do it for somebody else now." Yes! That's Christian leadership. One of my students, I taught at a university for 6 years, and one of my students, he was not my best student academically, but he might well have been my best student. I was training pastors. And he went out to be a junior high pastor at a church there in Southern California. Now, you know, junior high people, they're cool. You know what I mean? "Okay, go ahead, worship. I'll sit here or stand here." Now, I think he only knew three chords on the guitar, and no one would ever ask him to sing. But he got up in front of those young people and started worshiping, you know. He didn't tell them what they ought to do. He just started worshiping to lead them. He said, "For 6 months, I worshiped alone. They just stayed cool." Now, I thought, you know, I'm your teacher. I'm not sure I'd do that. You know? You're teaching me. But see, he loved those kids. And he didn't berate them after a couple of weeks and say, "What's wrong with you people?" You know? No. He just exampled worship. And he said after 6 months, it was just like, bam, they suddenly exploded in worship. Took 6 months of example. Well, really, eternally, that's not that long. But he understood. He had caught the nature of Jesus as I tried to teach it. And he lived as an example. How often I have heard in successful ministries where people would tell me, "You know what? I'm just following the example of our leader. And that means that I'm going to do what is right and best for you, regardless of how I feel about it." I'll explain that better tonight. And so Jesus just simply says, the only thing I want you to do is what I've shown you, what I've been the example for. I am your example. So don't get discouraged, even if you don't think you are seeing the results that you want to see. And that's the thing that we preachers have trouble with, because after we've preached one sermon, we expect wings to start growing out of your back. And we don't notice what's growing on the top of your head. Horns. But it upsets us if we do notice that. And it's a hard thing sometimes to preach to an unresponding crowd for a while. Unless if you're putting them down and beating them up, they're not going to respond except in some way to get out of there as fast as they can, you know. But Jesus, I'm convinced that Jesus, one of the reasons these apostles fought was because Jesus treated each one of them as if they were his favorite. He was so good to them, they each must have thought, I got to be your favorite. In fact, I'll go ahead and announce it. I am God's favorite. I know. The way he treats me proves it, see? And if you want to argue with me, I would appreciate that. Because I want you to feel like you're God's favorite too. Just as. So now you know that example is the, and I'm saying this to you because I consider all of you leaders, is the authorized method of leadership in the kingdom of God. And you know what? You can be the greatest leader in the world without ever having been elected to anything. That's not how you become a leader. That can destroy your leadership, really. But to get down in on this whole thing about foot washing, I have to tell you this about how God dealt with me. When I first realized this, I thought, you see, God's brought me on a long journey. I grew up in very legalistic circles. I thought my job was to point out dirty feet. You've got dirty feet. You've got dirty feet, you know. And I realized that finally that, you know, if people have dirty feet, I don't have to tell them that. They already know that. But then I improved to thinking that I was in charge of a giant fire hose to wash feet from the pulpit, you know. And I discovered I was knocking feet off their legs and sweeping them out the back door and couldn't understand why they left crippled, you know. And finally God got close enough to my heart to explain to me, if you're going to wash feet, you have to get close enough to people to touch them. Yeah. And that changed everything for me. I want to tell you a little story. It's true. I grew up in the Deep South, and so you know what my training was in terms of viewing people. But God dealt with me, for which I'm deeply grateful. And I was invited way back in 1978 to go to what was then Rhodesia to speak at the first charismatic renewal conference that would be racially mixed. It was a breakthrough. They didn't know who to get because whoever came had to pay his own way and would not be reimbursed for anything because they had laws that wouldn't permit it. And so one of my students who had recorded at my permission some of my classes said, listen to these. He had gone over to be part of the ministry that sponsored this. And so they decided to invite me. God had taught me some things, and when I was there, the divide between the locals and the whites, well, everybody was local there, but between the blacks and the whites was just, it was palpable. You could feel it. But I spent my time with the blacks. I got to know them. I loved them. They were great. I learned their names. I would eat with them, which was, they couldn't believe that. But one of the guys came up to me, a white guy, and said, you know, I'm going to break all the rules right now. I'm going to break the law by talking to you about this. But he said, I'm here as a member of the Secret Service. See, it was a white rule country. And I was appointed to watch you. And he said, if we had treated them the way you have this week, we would not be having a civil war right now. And I thought, man, I didn't realize it was that significant. But on Thursday of that week, they asked each of the speakers to do a luncheon talk where we explain how we got this way. Let me tell you how I got this way. And I decided, because of my past, to share how God had dealt with me here in this newly beginning to break through situation. And I noticed a black guy out there getting very excited. And when it was over, he came to me and said, would you go with me? I want to show you my office. Now, folks, I have seen offices. And I was about to tell him, well, thank you. I'd rather not, really, you know. But you know, sometimes you hear from God, and you know he just said, if you don't go, I'm going to have to kill you. So, yeah, I'll go. He's pointing at the clock back there. I'll finish this, and then I'll quit. So I went with him. It was only a couple of blocks away, and nobody knew this, he occupied the whole second story of a high-rise office building. Because, see, they didn't talk to each other. And when I walked in, every eye in that place went wide and stared, because I found out later I was the first white guy to go into that office. And this man, who now is ahead of millions of people around the world, said to me, where everyone could hear, I'm going to kneel down and I want you to lay hands on me and bless me. And I was getting ready to do that when, you know, I heard from God again, if you do, Irwin, I'll have to kill you. And so I grabbed him by the shoulders and lifted him up and I said, no, you're a much greater man than I am. I'm going to kneel down here and I want you to lay hands on me and bless me. Suddenly, I was a citizen of that country. Suddenly, every heart in the country became open to me. One guy who was a pastor, and he was quite wealthy because he was also a farmer too, and he had a mansion, man, in Harare. And I had spoken for him one Sunday, and he, after we'd been to his house to eat lunch, he said, God spoke to me last night and told me to give you my house. I said, really? And he said, I don't know why he didn't tell me, but here's what I think. You're the only man in this country to whom both the blacks and the whites are listening. And you need to live here. And I said, well, I'm going to turn this offer down, and let me tell you why. Because you're a white guy. The whites are always going to listen to me because of the color of my skin. But if you were black and gave me your house, I'd accept it. I'd move here. I would move here. Because that would cause them to realize I'm with them too. As it has worked out, I've had massive influence over there. I don't normally tell people this. Ezekiel Goody is the leader of millions of people. He's the biggest thing in Zimbabwe. I think he's the biggest thing in Africa. He's in about 40 countries now. No, over 100 countries now. I helped him write his theology. I wrote his biography. And when I go over there now, that book's still in print. It was written way back in the early 80s, late 70s. They just hold up the book and they say, the author of this book is speaking for us today. And I become suddenly a rock star. Okay, I'm finished. I'm way over time, so I think we have a break.